and good morning and welcome to a Red River Radio Spotlight. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio. And opening up at the Marjorie Lyons Playhouse next Thursday, October 8th at 7:30 p.m. is a production of Not About Nightingales, a drama by Tennessee Williams with a forgotten past. And joining me now in our Knoll Foundation studios to talk about this production are Logan Sledge, who's going to be the director for this production, along with John Brogan, who will play the warden, and also Aiden Poling, who takes on the role of Jim. And I want to welcome all you for joining in. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Bill.
So let's go into this is a fascinating background for a play, a Tennessee Williams play that was almost forgotten for 60 years, literally written in 1938, not produced until 1998. How does that come about happening? I mean, if you think about Tennessee Williams, right. He's like the icon of American theater and literature writing. How do we lose a play of his and then find it years later?
Well, and so prolific as a writer, you imagine anything that he's written, it's been produced, it's out there, right. You know, because there is so much of that. But it's just a unique story that happened with this particular play. He wrote it in 1938. As a 27-year-old, and he was trying to make an impression, I think, on the group theater, where he submitted the play with a number of his other plays. It was one of his first full lengths, though. He also submitted three shorter plays, one acts, to the group theater. They liked his one acts. They did not like the full length plays, mm-hmm. So they turned him down for that. But they did create a special one-time award for like $100, which a lot back then, yeah. For his short plays. So he saw that as a success, and he just shelved this manuscript.
Which is a shame when you think about it. But then again, if you read through some of the text, you think maybe this was a little too futuristic, I guess, too into the future, a little bit of ahead of its time. But you never know how to evaluate those. But obviously, years later, how did it come about being discovered? Because one of my favorite actresses is one of the ones who discovered it.
Yeah, Vanessa Redgrave, who you're talking about, obviously. And she was researching a role that she was playing in another Tennessee Williams play, Orpheus Descending. And I believe it used to be called Battle of Angels, and then it was retitled. But she was reading a biography and came across this title of this play that she'd never heard of. And it really got her interested in wondering, where was this play? Why hasn't she heard of it? And she kind of made it her personal mission to track this play down. Incidentally, it was kind of hiding in plain sight. It was in the Tennessee Williams archives in Texas. But it became a question of access. She couldn't get access to those archives until she kind of found a connection that got her in there. And then the search began, and she found the manuscript and then ended up getting it produced at the Alley Theater.
And then it went on when it finally did hit the stage. It won, what, 6 Tonys? I don't know how many Drama Desk Awards. So obviously it had literary merit, maybe just took a different generation to kind of see that merit to it. So
yeah, it was a very successful, I guess you would consider it a preview, you know, opening at the Alley Theater in Houston in 1998. I went down there and saw that production with Patrick McWilliams, Robert Busick, Lane Crockett, and a close friend of mine, Yuri McBride. We were there.
Wow.
We went and saw it, and you know, I was a 19-year-old kid, and it just blew my hair back, and it stayed with me. And I always kind of thought, you know, maybe if there's a chance to have a go at that, it'd be a fun thing to try.
Yeah.
But then, yes, as you said, a very, very successful, although short, Broadway run. There were some interesting cast conflicts. I don't want to go into too much detail,
right.
But the guy playing Aiden's role, Jim Finbar Lynch, created some unusual dynamics within the cast, and it kind of broke up that New York run.
Just didn't work for everybody.
Did
else,
not.
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, it must
sometimes
be the part, because Aiden is a real pill, and that's all I have to tell you. He really brings.
Well,
it.
You're given that you're the warden in this, so let's go into the dynamic a little bit between the warden. Who is the warden in this? This is John Brogan going to tell us his role.
As you can easily imagine, Tennessee Williams has very powerful villains, and so to find myself enlivening a part that hasn't been made a movie out of, and things, and so you suddenly are working with this dialogue, the text of this very strong bad guy. Now, villains are never entirely bad people. They don't certainly see themselves that way. The right. warden doesn't see himself that way. He's just in a situation where he becomes very bad because of his abuse of power. Right. And that is principally exercised upon Jim, who is an inmate, but who has been elevated to the office of the warden through some awful circumstances, but you'll have to see the play to know what those are. And the interaction with the warden and all of these lower status individuals, as he sees them, forms a lot of the dynamic of the play, and his abuse of his power upon those people really propels the script along.
Right. So how did you, Aiden, how did you end up in the pokey in this play, as they say?
Mm-hmm. Well, my character, Jim, when the action is taking place, he's been in prison for about 10 years. And when the action is taking place, he's about a month away from parole. And so he acts as sort of a stool pigeon for John's character, right. Warden.
And he's just basically trying to glide out. I mean, he's got a very short time, and you know he doesn't want to get in with the rest of the gang
exactly.
and be the troublemaker. I mean, he's on the verge of freedom,
right? You know? Right.
But makes that classic human error of falling in love.
Right.
especially falling in love with somebody who ends up being the secretary in this. Not good to date the secretary of the warden, I guess. Probably
additionally, the object of the warden's affection as well. And
right,
so
yeah.
You can see the layers of conflict that are going on there.
So let's go into Eva. Who is Eva in this, and who's playing her? Who on your cast is playing her?
A freshman named Tessa Anderson is playing Eva Crane.
And who is this person as Tennessee Williams portrays them?
Well, I see Eva like I see a lot of the other characters in the play, in that they're all at this great breaking point,
right.
And she at scene opening she is on the verge of a nervous breakdown. One interesting thing about the play is, you know, we're presenting this prison, and we're inside the prison the whole time. Ava's the one really that goes out and comes back and goes out and comes back,
right.
And as we first see her, you know, this is the depression. She's been out of work for 6 months.
Right.
She's fallen on incredibly hard times, and she needs this job desperately. You know, the it's one of the dynamics of the play that the juxtaposition of seeing, you know, these prisoners are so desperate to get out of this situation,
right.
You know, but then Ava is saying, you want out so badly, let me tell you what's out there.
Yeah.
It's not a pretty world out there right now.
In essence, she's a prison of poverty,
right.
and she's looking for an escape through a job at the prison,
right.
Whereas all the inmates are, they have three hots and a cot. Granted, it's not great accommodations, it's not a five-star hotel, but out in the real world at that particular time, it might be literally, you know, a knapsack under a tree, and that may be the best it gets for an ex-con.
Right.
So there's a lot of contrast and social commentary going on in the status of the world at that time, but also the status of what's going on in the prison. As the play opens, we have another woman involved, and that is the mother of the character named Sailor Jack. Can you give us a kind of a line on how those two characters play into beginning the development of the play?
Yeah, again, Mrs. Bristol is a foreigner to this world. Her son, Sailor Jack, was, you know, used to be in the Navy and was arrested. She thinks, of course, wrongfully so.
Right.
And Sailor Jack, you know, we watch his character in the beginning, and he's already been victimized by these circumstances. He's at the end of that,
right.
And then we see the impact that has on Mrs. Bristol when she discovers the true condition of her son,
right.
Left under this man's, you know, watch, and it breaks her down completely. So it's a powerful moment in the show, certainly.
So let's go in a little deeper into your character. As the play evolves, your character becomes involved with Eva, and they develop a romance, while at the same time the warden's trying to, you know, basically intimidate her or extort favors from her. So
right.
Ava is in a difficult world. It's a job, it's paying the bills, and she's working for somebody who is not treating her well at all, but the world was probably treating her worse. So it's a catch-22. It's what abuse do you take in life, you know, and suffer through.
And she offers very legitimate resistance to the warden. She has her pride. She's not a weak character, and she has her value system that she goes into the prison with, and she manages to hold out against the warden until the folly of love offers him the real card, the real tool to use against her love for Jim.
Right. So he essentially turns that against her in a way. She's in love with an inmate, but of course he's an inmate, so he plays that off against her.
And she's a beauty. I mean, she's the one beautiful, you know, attractive thing, right. Ray of sunshine in this prison, and that must be Warden Wayland's for the having.
Right, the single flower in the desert that's blooming. So, Aiden, can you take us through some of the other characters that we're going to see in this play?
Well, one of the main characters that you'll see is Butch, who is kind of the ringleader for the events to come. And he and Jim sort of have a bit of history together, thanks to the warden. Yeah. And then you'll also you'll see some characters that are kind of his little posse, like Joe and Swifty as well. And
so we've got an entourage hanging around him.
Absolutely.
And he's the ringleader, so he's the alpha male in the situation,
right,
basically.
Right.
So what is the drama that's going on behind the scenes? It's about the conditions of this prison, but we're not going to give away the ending, so we're going to build up to that. Can you lead us up to why the conclusion takes place as it does?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the big catalyst for the narrative and the plot development, outside of what we've already talked about, the love story that's developing, is the prisoners they're not happy with the conditions in the prison. They're most of all not happy with the food that they're being given at the prison, which is it has, you know, pet grafts in it. It's tearing all of their stomachs all apart. There's, you know, they're becoming sick, you know, left and right, ptomaine poisoning and all of this. And they decide to stage essentially a hunger strike to reject that food and to rebel against that. That's kind of the big key there, because that's really what the warden is trying to quell and get his grip on, so that word doesn't get out.
Right.
And there's a history of that happening, and the warden speaks to that. You know, once they go on hunger strike, papers find out. It's a feeding frenzy for the media. You know, and then all of a sudden, I'm you know, subject
out
to outside criticism,
right,
here. You know.
Yeah. So people are looking into our box. Mm-hmm. People are looking into our world. So. Ollie is one of the interesting characters in this. Can you tell us about Ollie?
Right. So Ollie is Jim's cellmate, and he's one of the only people that actually likes Jim in the entire prison, despite his status as a stool pigeon. And I don't know how much to say without giving anything away, but I would say he acts as sort of the catalyst for the hunger strike.
Okay.
He is punished for that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right,
right? We watch Ollie being punished as definitely stepping forward when they're, you know, striking at the mess hall and dinner hall, and you know, the warden as a warning to Butch, right? He leaves Butch alone. Butch is, you know, he's the kind of the king of the prison there. He leaves him alone, but he says, "I'm going to take these few, send him down to the hole for, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, as a way to send a signal." You know, again, one of the interesting dynamics is every time we have an office scene, you know, the warden is asking Jim, you know, how are things in Hall C? Jim is the one who reports, you know.
Right.
He's supposed to come back with the information. Well, Jim's also trying to navigate, okay, what do I do with this information?
Right.
Do I get it to Butch? You know, there's a scene where he tries to go and actually work and reaches out to Butch. Says, hey, you know, let's work together on this thing. I've got information. You know, if you're going on your own, it's probably not going to end well.
Right.
You know, Butch doesn't want to hear it. It's his way. You know, this is the only way.
Right.
So he turns Jim down on that offer. but it still puts them all in these really unique power positions as far as trying to give information, keep information, use information. And you can imagine this whole idea, and there are a couple of scenes that show this, I think, the way that information spreads, you know, spreads throughout a place like a prison.
Right.
Two very dangerous environments. The two principal settings take in the cells, the prisoner cells, and the office. They're both dangerous for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. And Jim is asked to traverse them both.
Right,
and
yeah.
In both settings, he gets cut. And the prisoners have their justice system, and then the warden has his justice system, and he doesn't get out of either one without his without the appropriate scrapes from each one.
Lots of scars. And it's also he's up against a warden who is a my way or the highway kind of character, and Butch, who seems to be also a my way or the highway kind of character. Only the two highways are vastly different, it seems like, although both lead to power, you know, and control.
And as you were talking about the build-up and stuff, it's when Butch and the warden meet,
right.
The two power brokers meet, that that justice, ultimate justice, gets distributed.
Yeah. And so where are you at, Aiden, when they do meet, and then the final confrontation, so to speak?
Well, during the final confrontation, Jim sort of decides to sacrifice his chance of parole, and decides to just, you know, in a desperate plea for freedom, just kind of...
He takes a leap of faith, let's just say.
Yes. We're not going to go any further, right. Because that would be the spoiler alert there, but let's just say there's a little bit of leaping involved.
Well, it's something interesting you just brought up, though, is that making that sacrifice, because
right.
That's another one of the kind of great ironies of the play, right? There, you know, who is going to talk? Who is going to tell the world about what's happening
right.
here? And Jim becomes very frustrated with Ava, rightfully so, because she's the one going out in the world every day. She, you know, she has that chance to go out and tell people of what's happening here and talk to the press and talk to the reporters. She doesn't. And why doesn't she? Well, because she needs her job.
You know? Puts her against herself.
Exactly.
Yeah, her own self-interest versus her moral repugnance at what's going on. And those are powerful internal conflicts.
And the same could be said for Jim. I
mm-hmm.
mean, you spend the length of the play going, well, will he do what he needs to do to get the parole?
Right.
Or will he side with the men
of
his own, you know, his prisoners? The other prisoners, and
right.
That's what you want to come to the show to find out.
And you always want it to be black and white, evil versus good, but of course life is not that way, and so you're conflicted, you know. I want to side with the men, some of them are jerks, I want to get out, but the warden's a complete, you know, whatever, I mean, expletive deleted.
Right.
So where do I go? Because right now I'm getting a paycheck and I got three hots and a cot, and I was starving before.
And not to get, we won't give the end away, but we've spent many, we've whiled many an hour away at rehearsal debating the end and things, because though he was young and though it was rejected by the theater group and stuff, he masterfully leaves you with a debate that you'll be having in the lobby, I think, as a
the cliffhanger
as a guest.
That goes on to the dinner table afterwards.
You will be like us and saying your opinion on how it came out.
It's one of those mysteries that we'll leave to you all, the audience, to figure out later on. So, well, let's get to the nuts and bolts. How do folks find out information about this and ticket information?
Well, basically, the box office is now open, so you can go to our webpage, and that's on Centenary's homepage, and then you just click on the theater link, and centenary.edu, and it'll take you right there. To our box office, you can also use the phone number. It's 869-5242. And get your ticket. One interesting thing that I would like to go ahead and say is our evening performances will be starting at 7:30 for this production, as opposed to 8, which has, I guess, been the way it's been for certainly when I was there. Forever. So
let's for the Facebook, the social media users out there, help me think of that Facebook page, ML Playhouse on Facebook.
I think it's just Marjorie Lyons.
Okay.
Look for us on Facebook. They've got an event. They've got a lot of good information on there. So we will be doing our social
media. If you just Google Marjorie Lyons Playhouse, it'll be in their subdata somewhere. Right. So it'll come up, you know, and you'll be able to find that. So, and I did want to get to the visual elements of this.
Oh, sure.
You're portraying various aspects of a prison. And of course, the visuals on a stage, whether it's an Augusta Wilson, you know, sparse, just a fence line in a front porch kind of design, or whether it's, you know, Cecil B. DeMille's, it all conveys something. What kind of a design are you using in this play?
Well, yeah, Don and I went back and forth all summer long. It seems like trying to, Don Hooper, the chair of the department and the scenic designer, trying to determine, okay, is this going to be a static, you know, a static, a fixed thing set visually, where we've got maybe the prison on one side and the warden on the other, or the, you know, the prison down here and the warden's desk above that, something like that? Or is it going to be this dynamic thing? And we settled on the dynamic, obviously. We have these, you know, monstrous walls. walls are mentioned a lot in this play. And obviously we're in this prison. And, you know, they're 8 feet by 16 feet, you know, and they are on tracks that slide across and move across, and they create, I think they allow us to have more of a cinematic approach to the style of the show and the movement of the show, which I always find interesting.
It's easy for me to imagine your listeners out there familiar with the long, long history at Marjorie Lyons Playhouse of exceptional designs and the tech there and kind of stuff. This continues that tradition. They've been doing beautiful technical productions for a long, long time, and this is very much in keeping with that. But with a more modern representational feel than you know, nobody builds those houses like they do, and the lights and all those details. Right. But this is contemporary and. Which is interesting to lay on top of a 1930s script.
And so, and one of the things I just, you know, because this is a student organization that's doing this, this is a chance for students to learn everything from how do you move a huge heavy wall across a stage like mice's feet, you know,
right.
And all of the technical aspects. So this is really a great chance to really dig in and learn theater production, you know, to the depth of it, so...
They challenge these young people very, very much. This is not a simple tech show, and the actors are the crew, and everybody has to chip in. And these are young people with varying levels of experience, and they are put to the task, and they have to move it like ice skaters. And really and truly, so far, they're doing that beautifully.
Right. And so I always encourage folks, get out, because I've worked at universities for 20 years. Get out and support the students, because when I'm old and gray and walking into the theater with my Walker, I want these kids on stage as professionals performing for me in the future, because that's what we're doing. We're carrying on this great legacy of theater and music and arts in this country, and the next generation is it.
That's
They're
it.
The
that's
ones
it.
Who are going to carry on the tradition. So, well, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with folks to get them out to the theater?
You know, it might be interesting just as an exercise in educating yourself before you go and see the show. You know, go to your computer and Google, you know, the Holmesburg Horror. This play was based on a real event. It's something we didn't really get to touch on, you know, this afternoon.
Right.
But it was known as the Holmesburg Horror. It's an event that took place in 1938 that Tennessee Williams read in a newspaper article on, obviously. And the events in this play really, really parallel those actual events that took place there at this prison in Philadelphia.
Logan, let me point out, too, help me with this. After one of the performances, the staff is having a Q&A.
Yes.
A discussion. And
yes.
I think that's an extraordinary opportunity for people who have a greater interest in Tennessee Williams and the production process at Marjorie Lyons. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you for the reminder. before I go back to the school and get in trouble. we are having a talk back session, and it's going to be October 8th, Thursday night, following our opening night performance. And we've invited three professors from around the campus, Dr. Volkemir, who's from the sociology department, and Dr. Chen from the philosophy department, and Dr. Levan, who's from the Office of Global Engagement. And they will be watching the show that evening, and they'll have some thoughts to offer from their various fields. And they will use what they see in the production to sort of connect back to what our theme for the season at MLP, which is why unto others.
Right.
And each show, I think, connects to that theme in a different way. So they'll speak to that some, and then we will also have a time to kind of turn it over to the audience to ask some questions. And
great.
And a student, actually, that's in the cast, Stephen Knight, who is wonderful at these things, is going to be moderating that event.
Oh, excellent. So, well, Logan, John, and Aidan, I want to thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thanks. Appreciate it.
That was director Logan Sledge, along with John Brogan, who plays the warden in this production, and Aidan Poling, who will be taking the role of Jim in an upcoming production of the Marjorie Lyons Playhouse performance of Tennessee Williams' play Not About Nightingales. And they join me in our Knoll Foundation studios today to fill us in on many of the details. The show opens next Thursday, October 8th at 7:30 p.m. with performances Friday and Saturday, October 9th and 10th at 7:30 p.m. and a 2 p.m. matinee performance on Sunday, October 11th. For complete details, you can visit them online at www.centenary.edu/playhouse or call 318-869-5242. That's 318-869-5242. This has been a Red River Radio Spotlight, and for Red River Radio, I'm Bill Beckett.